people who in the Democratic Party
who want to defund the police? That was the question. The answer?
Are there people in the Republican Party who think we're sucking the blood out of kids?
Good one, Joe. Good one.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Elsewhere in California, on KFOI, Red Bluff, Redding, KKRN, Round Mountain, KGOE, Eureka. In Oregon, on KYAQ on the Central Coast, KSO in Cottage Grove, KEPW in Eugene. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, WLRI. Maui, Hawaii, KAKU. Columbus, Ohio, WGRN. Palinville, New York, WLPP. Rochester, New York, WRFZ. New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ, Seattle, Washington, KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF, and coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing the globe 5 days a week, usually hosted by Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com with an assist from Desi Doyen. But today, once again, you got me. I'm Nicole Sandler. I host The Nicole Sandler Show based at NicoleSandler.com. And I'm coming to the rescue today because Brad's computer has melted down. And I know what that's like. I have sympathy. Today on The Bradcast, I'm sharing with you an interview from last week with author, journalist, and copyright and antitrust activist Cory Doctorow. If you're not familiar with Cory Doctorow, you should be. He's published a slew of books that cross categories. He's a prolific science fiction author. He's written a bunch of young adult novels and a number of nonfiction books dealing with today's topic and more. You can get info on his books at craphound.com. Cory also blogs daily at pluralistic.net, or you can subscribe to that same content in his daily Substack newsletter. And you can certainly follow Cory Doctorow on Twitter at Doctorow, D-O-C-T-O-R-O-W. So here's what happened. In the middle of June, I was fortunate enough to have Cory as a guest on my show for the very first time. As I typically do, I allotted 30 minutes for the interview. That wasn't enough. So at the end of the show, we immediately booked him for another appearance the following month and set aside the whole hour. Well, that happened last Monday. The interview followed President Biden's announcement made the previous Friday about a massive executive order to encourage competition and reduce the monopolies that are strangling the nation. But that wasn't the only example of fortuitous timing. During our first interview, Cory told us that there was significant antitrust legislation working its way through Congress. And indeed, it hit the news the following week. So I began our second interview by playing that clip from our first.
I know we're out of time, but I'll say that I happen to know that the Senate is about to drop 5 anti-monopoly bills regulating tech.
Really? Oh, well, and that's huge.
I have read them and commented on them, as have many allies, and I think they are, by and large, very good bills. And they have bipartisan support.
Wow.
And so we are seeing movement for a reinvigorated muscular antitrust that has not been seen in this country in a century. And it's a watershed moment. And, you know, if you're angry.
Okay, so I could keep going, but I've got the real thing here. But so you said that, and sure enough, like 2 days later, the news broke that the House was actually going to mark up these bills.
I was wrong. I just misspoke. It was the House. And there was a sixth bill we didn't know about that came out at the same time. Six bills, all in the House. Yep. It was quite a moment.
So that happened, and that would have been enough. And then Friday morning, I wake up, and I get up early in the morning, and I do a newscast. It was the first time I had heard I'm reading this. It's like today Joe Biden is going to sign an executive order, like working against monopolies and encouraging competition. It's like, where did this come from? And oh my God, what he put out there was, to quote Joe Biden when he was vice president, a big deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was remarkable. And you know, I've been giving this a lot of thought because it's a rare moment in which the political class is actually out ahead of the constituency. Mm. I mean, we have a lot of issues like, say, you know, universal health care, where there's a really broad bipartisan consensus among voters that this is a thing we should have. It's just not something that the political classes are willing to give us. In this case, I think what's happened that's remarkable is there are lots of people in the public who are angry about a monopoly. So they're angry about their healthcare insurer. They're angry about big tech. They're angry about their cable operator. They're angry about the restaurant chain that's their only employer that's bought all the other restaurant chains. You know, they're or Amazon, right? Uh-huh. So they're angry about these things. What they're not angry about is monopoly itself. And what's interesting is that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and in the House and in the Senate and in the White House have named the problem, like, and it's real. Actual political leadership. I mean, this feels weird, right? I mean, it's not a thing we're used to, but it's actual political leadership. It's people who have a kind of bird's eye view of the common thing that runs through the current, that runs through all of these different problems that people are having with their energy providers or with their banks or whatever, and going, oh, wait a second. It's a finance issue and it's an energy issue and whatever, but the reason it's a finance issue is that there's a monopoly there. Uh-huh. And they're saying, we should strike at this at the root. We have to do something about the EPA phenomenon, you know, the way that it surfaces in your life. We need to do something about finance. We need to do something about logistics and whatever. But if we don't want to have to keep doing this, we need to actually go back to a more pluralistic, less corporate centered way of organizing our national and global affairs. It's amazing.
It is. And so the fact that, I mean, on two fronts, this is happening. And as far as I can tell, and I could be way wrong here, it doesn't seem like they were interconnected. It seemed like two separate things. I'm talking about
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, you look at, so first of all, I think the same campaign staffers and the same White House staffers are talking to the same administrative agency staffers and the same activists. Uh-huh. Right. I think that there's, it's not coordinated in the sense that there's a smoke-filled room filled with trust busters who've launched it.
Too
but
bad.
You know, when you look at the laws that were introduced, the bills that were introduced by in the House, they put an enormous emphasis on the FTC. And the FTC has been a sick and brutalized agency for a long time. It's been, you know, it's had massive cuts. It voluntarily at one point sat down and like voted to tie its own hands and not use most of its enforcement powers. It's done all kinds of stuff and it's just been demoralized it wasn't like a great agency. And the Biden administration put Lina Khan in charge of it. So first they put Lina Khan up for confirmation as a commissioner. And that was a big deal because Khan is like 3.5 years out of law school.
Wow.
She wrote this seminal paper in law school while she was at Yale called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox that diagnosed the entire, collapsing ideology of like Reagan era antitrust enforcement that we've been living with for 40 years and explained how the world that we got to now is the result of it, articulated its problems and suggested its solution and launched, you know, sort of modern antitrust. So they make her a commissioner. And then like the next day he's like, oh, and by the way, she's the chair. And so, you know, one of the bills that went through the Congress was like, we just got to give a lot more money to the FTC. And it wasn't just any FTC. It was Lina Khan's FTC, you know. And so, you know, when you look at the Biden executive order, most of it is directing the FTC to do stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I don't want to be like a hero worshiper here or a cult of personality person. Khan is incredibly important. She's definitely the right person at the right time in the right job. There are lots of people who are very good here. One of them, Commissioner Chopra, is being yanked out of the FTC and put in charge of the Consumer Finance Protection Board.
Right.
But
you know, they have chosen someone who is like not a swamp dweller, whose ideology is well understood, who has a record for like diagnosing problems and suggesting like effective remedies, who has this incredible credibility. And the programs in the legislature and in the administration, they're structured around her, around, you know, personnel as policy, around the she and the people who she surrounded herself with. I think it's I think it's tactically very shrewd, right? Like I as opposed to being like a conspiracy, I think it's just someone sat down and said, we have this incredible person that we can put in play. We have a sense of what her capabilities are. We have these other priorities, and she can be a linchpin for them. And, you know, you see on the other side that there's like energy to get rid of her. So, you know, a traditional tactic, if you don't like a bill, is to propose another bill that purports to do the same thing and does nothing of the kind. So Some Senate Republicans have introduced an antitrust bill that has no antitrust in it. All it says is like, Lena Khan can't do antitrust anymore. Like that's the
My God!
It's not all the DOJ and the FTC is out of a job here. And you know, Amazon. This was really good. Amazon said, Lena Khan has previously said that she thinks Amazon is a monopolist, so she shouldn't be allowed to prosecute Amazon for monopoly tactics because she's biased because she thinks we're a monopoly."
Oh my God. Now, Corey, they're as great. And Lena Khan, I've heard only amazing things about her, and people on the left, real progressives, are excited that she's in this role, but they're missing an important key player in this, right? Joe Biden still has not chosen or nominated anyone to be the assistant attorney general to head up the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. Isn't this a big deal? Like, shouldn't somebody be in place or at least in the queue to get confirmed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't pretend to be like a Hill insider or anything, but that feels like a big omission to me too. And, you know, if we want to play Kremlinology here, like maybe it represents some kind of internal contest between party bosses and progressives about who can get there. But that's pure speculation. I mean, I've seen interesting stuff about like the ambassadorial appointments where like none of them are bundlers, none of them are fundraisers, they're just qualified people.
Wow.
I mean, some of them are people I disagree with, but none of them are like just some person who has a bunch of rich friends who threw a really big benefit dinner, which, you know, that's pretty interesting too. It's a very technocratic way of governing, which is to say it's like oriented around expertise and knowledge and track records as opposed to, you know, whose turn it is.
Right.
That can be good or bad depending on like the action. Like there are lots of people who have lots of technical knowledge who I think are just wrong, but they're not wrong because they're ignorant. They're wrong because they're ideologically flawed. But you know, that marks a really serious break from the politics of say the Trump administration, or even, you know, to a large extent, the Clinton administration. Uh-huh. You know, it's much less a swamp creature kind of thing. And I think a lot of us looked at Biden, who frankly, I think his pitch for the nomination is, it's my turn. I'm not the best guy for the job, but it's my turn.
Right.
And thought that would be his governance style. And weirdly enough, it's not.
Right. Believe me, I've been shocked and pleasantly surprised. And again, I'm not going to agree with everything. But even if I were president, I wouldn't agree with everything I did because things change. And sometimes, you know, that's politics. You have to compromise.
You're a prisoner of your circumstances.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But pleasantly surprised, definitely. So let's start with the markups, because this was like a 26-hour marathon session, right?
It was
strange bedfellows too. It was just a weird divide of the who was on board with it and who wasn't.
Yeah, when you get like Matt Gaetz saying, I agree with Pramila Jayapal, we really need to make this happen. It's something weird is going on.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that we heard a lot from, I mean, I'm really interested in what the Democrats have to say about this, because it's clearly not a united party on this. Zoe Lofgren, who has historically been very progressive, but is also from Silicon Valley,
right,
and has gone back and forth on what she thinks of. She said a bunch of things that I didn't think were right in voicing her objections to some of these bills. She also said she also made some amendments that were proposed that were right on, some of which were voted down. And, you know, I'm interested in counting noses in the party. I'm also really interested in what the people on the other side are saying, because there's this funny thing that's happening right now. You know, you've heard this stuff about conservative voices being censored on social media. This came up a lot in the markup. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, unpopular opinion, it's true, but it's not true that they're being censored because they're conservative. They're being censored as part of a long run of platform censorship that includes censorship of anti-pipeline activists and Palestinian mm-hmm. activists and Black Lives Matter activists. The reality is that forbearance on mergers and predatory conduct has concentrated all the decision-making about our public sphere into a few hands. And, you know, there are people who will say, oh, well, censorship is only state action, right? It's not private action. And there's like some formal sense in which that's true, but it's really more of a, that's kind of a semantic game. Because for me, the most significant thing about the relationship of the state to the censorship is that the state had the power at every juncture as big tech was concentrating, as the web was being boiled down to like five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. The state had every opportunity to intervene and put the brakes on and say, mm-hmm. no, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, you can't buy Instagram just because people hate Facebook and they're joining Instagram. Right? Right. But that's a reason not to let you buy Instagram, not a reason to let you buy Instagram. And instead, we just sat back and we allowed these anti-competitive mergers to take place. And now what's happened is, without any kind of state action to limit speech, we've arrived at a place where state inaction has created speech regimes that are being managed not by governments whom we could contest in democratic forums, right? Like, imagine if there were government rules about what you could say on the internet. We could ask our lawmakers to change them. Uh-huh. And instead, those rules are just being made by the content moderation departments of a couple of giant companies. And that's like, that's worse in some ways than state censorship, at least democratic state censorship, where you could ask to have the rules changed. I mean, I grew up in Canada. We have rules about what you can and can't say, and we can contest those rules in parliament. It doesn't always work out well. We can go to court over it. You know, like the rules are at least arrived at through like a democratic and accountable process. This is not that.
No, right? this is arbitrary. And it's yeah. not only Facebook, it's Twitter, it's LinkedIn, it's all of these online services arbitrarily suspending people for something that they posted, even when the meaning of what they posted was totally misconstrued. And on top of that, they give you no recourse. They don't give you yeah. an opportunity. They don't tell you why, what you allegedly did, and they don't give you a chance to contest it.
So, and you know, there are ways that we could address this. And the Republican answer has been not great, right? The Republican answer is quite silly. It's to, you know, you've seen it in these silly season bills in Florida and so on, to just ban companies from moderating or even mm-hmm. from like having a sort order somehow. Like, you're not allowed to put some things above other things. I don't know how that works. Do you just have like every tweet is on your screen at once in a blob layered on top? Like, I don't know how that could possibly work.
Well, it's
work,
Ron DeSantis, so he doesn't know either.
Right. You know. But if you want to ask yourself, like, why do people care, right? Like, why is it that Gab failed, you know, in addition to its technical problems?
Okay.
It's the same reason that anti-pipeline activists don't leave Facebook, even though they keep getting censored. It's because their communities are there.
Right.
And it's because the people that they want to join in common cause with are there. And there's a word for this from like economics jargon. It's called a network effect. And that's when a product or a service gets better, the more people who use it. So like, you join Facebook because of the people who are already there. Other people are joining Facebook because you're there.
Right.
And so that's how firms get very big, but it's not how they stay big. The way that they stay big is through making the switching costs very high. So the switching cost is another economics term. It's what you have to give up to leave the service. Mm-hmm. Like, if you quit Facebook, you leave behind your friends, your community, maybe your customers. It costs you a lot. And normally the way that those switching costs are overcome, historically, like with things like MySpace, was just, you know, people just sort of left en masse. But that gets harder the bigger the firm is, the bigger the service is. You have to organize this big collective action problem where you have to leave and your friends have to leave and their friends have to leave. You all have to leave, and it's just really hard. But there's another way to do this with tech, which is to have interoperability. That's right. When one service plugs into another service. Yes.
You wrote about this today at pluralistic.net, and you write about the Access Act, and would fix this. Yes.
Yeah. So that was one of the bills introduced, right? So the Access Act says that big firms like Facebook will have to let new firms plug in. Those could be co-ops or startups or just tinkerers building a site on their own. And there's rules about who can plug into them. You know, those companies can't monetize data, so they can't be, you know, in the business of spying on users. They have to get consent. So if you take your friend's data with you, like you think about it, like, is your friend's message to you, is that your data or their data? And you've got it, you know, there's a consent regime and contemplated by it and so on. It's still a little vague, but you know, that can be firmed up in further amendments and so on. But what it has the effect of doing is lowering the switching cost, because what it would mean is that you could quit Facebook, but not quit the people who are left behind. And instead of 3 billion Facebook users being a reason to join Facebook, they'd be a reason to leave it, because you could still talk to those people without subjecting yourself to the commodification of your relationships that comes from being a Facebook user. So you get the best of both worlds. You get all the benefits you get from using Facebook without the problems. And if you don't like their moderation policies, you can have your own.
Right. And see, this is so timely, because I've had this conversation with so many people. I'd love to leave Facebook. The thing is, you know what? I lived and worked in Los Angeles for 15 years. It was a big part of my life. And if not for Facebook, I would have no contact with so many people that were, and I worked in music radio. So the work and pleasure combined. So the people that I worked with were friendly, you know, and so it's the only way I keep in touch with these people. So I am loath to leave for that reason, but I'd love to leave because it's Facebook.
It's mutual hostage taking.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Facebook doesn't have users, it has hostages, but the person who took them hostages are the users themselves. Mm. You're there because your friends are there. Your friends are there because you're there.
Right.
The problem of organizing everybody leaving for somewhere else is insurmountable. And so you're just stuck. So the idea that we could rather than like try to fix Facebook, like try to find a version of Mark Zuckerberg who's finally qualified to be the conversation czar of 3 billion people speaking 1,000 languages in 150 countries, rather than trying to make that happen, maybe what we could do is make it easier for people to go, to address the reason that people stay. And we could make Facebook less central. We could make the mistakes that Facebook makes, which, you know, any firm is going to make. I've run message boards. We've made moderation mistakes too.
Sure.
The difference being that my moderation mistakes affect 6 people or 100 people,
right.
Not 3 billion people. And so that, I think, addresses the concerns that some of these Republicans are having. And I think there's an opportunity for like something really bipartisan to happen here, that, you know, I'm not saying like first they came for the Nazis and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Nazi. I'm saying first they came for everybody else, the pipeline activists, the trans activists and the sex worker advocates and the Black Lives Matter advocates, and nobody said anything. And finally, they've come for the far right. Like
now, right.
Maybe now we can have a coalition that can do something, that can actually get something done. And, you know, interoperability, it's not perfect. It's not a panacea, but what it does do is it cuts the supply lines for big tech, because the way that big tech is able to command such enormous sums, right? Facebook and Google collectively have about 80% of the display market ad market. About 50% of every advertising dollar goes straight into their pocket. It's much more expensive to advertise because of them. You know, people talk about Google stealing content from news sites. That's BS, right? That's not happening. What is happening is Google is stealing ad dollars.
Oh, yes.
Right? Like they're pocketing really high commissions using these ad markets. You know, this has come up in some of the litigation against Google. They run these ad markets where they are the sell side and the buy side. So it's like, imagine if NASDAQ was run by one of the companies listed on NASDAQ,
right.
And it set the terms for buying and selling shares. And one of the things it did was actually like mediate between all the companies that do stuff. So say it was run by like an ISP. And if you wanted to be a high-tech company, you had to make the ISP happy in order to buy and sell shares, right? Like a marketplace where the marketplace maker participates in the marketplace is like a football game where the referee is on one of the teams,
right.
But they swear blind that their calls will be fair. And we can see from the evidence that the calls aren't fair, right? Like Google and Facebook at one point explicitly colluded to rig these markets. That also came out in some of this antitrust litigation. And so, you know, like if we want to make these systems fairer, then we have to cut their supply lines. We have to give them less money to lobby. We have to give them less power over our lives. One of the ways we do that is by peeling off their users into rival services that aren't interested in commodifying us, that aren't as kind of vampiric in the way that they relate to the supply chains that they're part of, that don't have the market or the political power to abuse the other people in the chain, including customers and suppliers, and that don't have the clout with lawmakers that these big firms have. That, you know, like Facebook can pay the former deputy prime minister of the United Kingdom $4 million a year to traipse around the world explaining that Facebook is good for democracy.
Oh, God.
We need to cut their supply lines so they can't afford to do that anymore. And when they can't afford to do that anymore, it's going to be harder for them to secure the special privileges that they have. And it's going to be harder for them to resist more meaningful action like breakups, unwinding their illicit mergers, blocking their anti-competitive conduct, and so on. It's the end of the thread that we can pull on that could unravel the whole sweater.
Cory Doctorow on the subject of antitrust, monopolies, and maybe a cure on the horizon. Back with Cory Doctorow in just a moment. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast. You're listening to The Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today, talking with author and activist, I suppose. He's so much more than that, Cory Doctorow. We're talking about the massive executive order that President Joe Biden signed just a couple of weeks ago, encouraging competition and hopefully putting limits on monopolies. This is one of Cory Doctorow's big issues. Let's pick up the conversation here. You said, if I read you correctly, that you got to start with tech, that that's where this has to start. Is that because it's the tentacles reach everywhere?
It's for a couple of reasons. So one is that, like, the only way, like, chicken farmers are going to organize to resist Purdue and the other big chicken meat packers is over the internet,
right?
Like, they're at farms at the end of lonely country roads, right? The only way people who are angry about pharmaceuticals or trucking labor arrangements, like, the logistics industry is so dirty and ugly right now. It basically makes Uber look like a good labor market, right? Truckers on the road need the internet to organize, Teamster style labor activism, right? So we need the internet. We need the internet because these companies are transnational. So we need to make solidarity in other territories with other people, you know, and learn from them and work with them collaboratively. But then there's, like, a technical reason that we need to start with tech, or that starting with tech makes sense, which is that tech has this interoperability stuff, right? Like, it's hard to make physical stuff interoperate. Like, sometimes it's easy. Like, you know, Nike can't force you to use official Nike shoelaces. You can just put a piece of string in there, right? Like, railroads, it's a lot harder. 150 years ago in Australia, they laid 6 different gauges of rail, one in each state, because everybody wanted their own standard. You can't get a piece of rolling stock across the country. They've tried 300 designs over 150 years to try and fix what they call the multi-gauge muddle. And the only answer is, like, tearing up thousands of kilometers of rail track and laying new track. That's not a problem with tech, right? If this were, like, 6 different word processor formats, you just get some programmers to work on it for a couple of months, and they just, like, make importers for all of them. It'd be fine. So we can, like, Facebook has its own gauge of rail, and Twitter has its own gauge of rail, and, you know, YouTube comments have their own gauge of rail, and LinkedIn communities have their own gauge of rail. And if they were physically, like, steel laid across the Australian outback, we would be so screwed. But because they're purely digital, we can do something intermediate. We can do something that gives us relief right now, and that will make those services far better suited to be the substrate for an activist moment that attacks monopolism in every domain. And you mentioned Biden's EO.
Yes.
One of the things about that executive order that's super exciting is that it's not just about tech.
No.
He explicitly makes the connection to, like, pharma and trucking and all kinds of industries.
All kinds of stuff. Everything. I mean, this is where I was going to segue to next. So you start with tech, and the bills that had the markup last week were mostly dealing with tech. But then Biden goes into this long 72 different provisions in this executive order, everything from banning non-compete agreements, which I love because, being in radio, I've been subject to them for years, allowing the importation of Canadian drugs, the formation of a public option included in there, right to repair Honestly, this was an issue I wasn't even aware of before, but it has impacted me when it comes to like a cell phone, that if you take your cell phone to somebody, an independent repair shop, they're going to say, well, your warranty is void. You have to bring it to us to fix it. But it's bigger in agriculture, where is it Caterpillar? Says a tractor.
No,
who is it?
Deer.
It's Deer.
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 Although they're all terrible, but Deer is the worst. Deer is like the arch nemesis here.
So Deer says you're not allowed to fix your own tractor, you farmer who's worked on your own equipment forever.
Because since the first forge and the first farm in Neolithic times.
Right. This is big.
Yeah. I mean, repair is huge. So repair is, depending on who you ask and how you count, between 1 and 5% of the US GDP. If you landfill like a ton of e-waste, you create like 2 jobs. And if you recycle it, you create like 15 jobs. And if you repair it, you create 150 jobs. And they're middle class, good, stable jobs in your community.
So
people don't send their phones to China to get them fixed. And they certainly don't send their cars to China to get them fixed.
Right.
So these are local businesses that allow people who don't have a 4-year degree, who can go, who can learn repair, you know, out of high school.
Sure.
It allows them to create good, stable, middle-class jobs. It's a path into the middle class like we had after the New Deal. And they do, and those jobs aren't jobs like coal mining, which are destroying the world. They're jobs that are saving the world, that divert conflict minerals and e-waste from the waste stream, mm-hmm. and that keep plastics out of our landfills and our oceans, and that let your neighbors get more value out of the things that they own. And, you know, you mentioned John Deere and the ag side of it. They've been our kind of poster child for this. They went to the copyright office, and I believe it was either 2015 or 2018. There are hearings at the copyright office on this every 3 years. So it was either the 15 or the 18 hearings. They went and they said, you don't own your tractor. You think you own your tractor, but you don't own your tractor because your tractor without its software is just a hunk of steel. And the software was never sold to you. It's a copyrighted work. It's licensed to you.
God.
And we've licensed it to you on the terms that say you're not allowed to fix your tractor. And here's the crazy thing. Farmers actually do fix their tractors under the scheme. So you have the diagnostic tool on your dashboard. It tells you what part is broken. You replace the part. What John Deere does is it locks your tractor up after you replace the part until you've paid $170 and waited for a technician to come out and, quote, inspect your repair and type an unlock code into the console. And that's what they're charging you for. So it's not even the right to repair. It's the right to be shaken down.
Right.
Right. So it's not just Deere.
No, it's
right to repair bills introduced in, I believe, 18 legislatures in 2018. And they're now more than half the legislatures in the US have right to repair bills in front of them for 2021. All of them were defeated in 2018 by a coalition that was led by Apple, but included Google, but also Wahl, the people who make the shavers.
Uh-huh.
I have a Wahl shaver and it got dull, and I ordered a sharpening stone, and I took it apart and it went sprung and the screws flew all over the place. And there was a spring in it. It was just crazy. And I called them up and they were like, that is not a user sharpenable shaver. You have to buy a new blade for it. So Wahl was a part of this. Wahl said, if you let people repair their shavers, they will explode and blow their heads off. GM was a part of this. GM also told the copyright office, you don't own your car. They said that your car software belongs to GM. It can't be sold. It's only licensed. And the licensing terms prohibit you fixing your own car. Every class of goods is in on this. And it isn't just about extracting money from you for the repair, although that's a big part of it. It's also making sure that you only buy original non-refurbished parts.
Right.
And that
from
there
them.
Are parts intended for domestic consumption. So like Apple blocks Apple parts being shipped from other parts of the world at the border as trademark violations. They print tiny little microscopic apples on parts that are never shown so that they can use trademark law to block these at the border so that refurbishers can't get access to them because they only sell parts to people who opt into their authorized service program.
God.
And so if you just want to be an independent iPhone repairer, you have to get your parts from somewhere else, and they block their own parts as counterfeit. So they can charge you extra for parts. And of course, automakers would love to do this. You know, I grew up in Ontario. we not only had a big Rust Belt that was making cars, but next to all of those car factories were factories that were making replacement parts that weren't GM or Ford parts. They were independent parts. People became billionaires off of these things, often terrible people, but you know, that doesn't mean that their parts were bad. And so they can force you to buy their own parts. And then here's the really insidious thing. They can decide when your device is no longer eligible to be repaired. Because they can say, oh, I'm sorry, we no longer carry parts. We don't fix devices.
Right. We don't support that anymore.
Make parts for them. Right. Right. Yeah. And so, and you know, hey, we'll give you $200 towards the price to a trade-in towards the price of a new device. So this is just a way of like trashing our planet and our future while picking our pockets. If you buy NVIDIA's little Chrome stick that you plug into your TV that lets you stream video,
right?
You know, you pay a premium. It's their high-end 4K version for it. And starting last week, they started plastering more than half your screen with ads.
Oh,
and there's no way to update it. There's no way to change it because it's got these software locks. It's illegal to break the software locks. No one's allowed to do third-party service on them. You're paying for the product and you're the product. The thing that determines whether you're going to be the product is not whether you pay or you don't pay. It's whether the company is afraid that they'll get in trouble, that they'll lose your business, that they'll get hit with a lawsuit, that there'll be some government enforcement if they treat you as the product. And if they have something to fear, they'll respect you. And if they know you have nowhere to go and you're locked in, there's no reason they're going to treat you well. Why would they?
Right. In the legislation that's working its way through Congress and in Joe Biden's executive order, is any of this addressed?
It is. So the right to repair stuff's really interesting because the first cut of the right to repair that kind of leaked out a couple of days ahead of time was just for ag. It's just for farm equipment. And there was a lot of concern about that. Like on the one hand, it's a great win. But on the other hand, farmers are incredibly well organized. Like you ever hear of a little thing called the Farm Bill? You know, they're really good at getting stuff done in DC. Mm-hmm. And the idea that farmers would be peeled off of the wider right to repair fight was really scary because it would probably doom the rest of the fight to many more years of fighting. And it's been united. So this right to repair bill is going to go a long way. The other thing that happened, you remember I said that the FTC a couple of decades ago sat down and voted not to use its enforcement powers anymore.
Yes.
First order of business for Lena Khan was to sit down and vote to give them back.
Right.
And you should have heard the howls from, you know, Chicago School economist, the son of Robert Bork, who is the architect of modern monopoly theory, Robert Bork Jr., just went on a tear going like, how dare they, you know, don't they understand that it's like universally accepted wisdom that my dad was super smart and everything he said was right. And the fact that we are now living in a world with like, you know, 5 publishers and 4 talent agencies and 3 record labels and 2
radio companies,
giant, studios and 1, you know, massive theater chain.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's like all working by design. You know, the world doesn't need more than 1 company that makes eyeglasses. The fact that Luxottica owns every eyeglass brand and the largest lens maker and, you know, every high street retail eyewear store you've ever heard of, that's fine. It's fine. And the fact that prices went up 1,000% over the last decade, it has nothing to do with my dad's theories that let one company corner the market on your right to see stuff.
Right. You know, and the fact that we can get reading glasses in the drugstore for $5-$10, this grew out of legislation. And I think it led to the provision that Joe Biden mentioned the other day about hearing aids that, you know, I guess now, and my hearing shot from so many years, you know, doing radio with very loud headphones on my
head. I was a Walkman kid, so I'm just a few years behind.
Right. But it's thousands of dollars for hearing aids. But he said, with this, you can go in the drugstore instead of $6,000, it'll cost you a couple hundred. That's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, all of this stuff is a big deal. You know, you hear about people whose powered wheelchairs need service and you can only get official service and they just can't go anywhere for days or weeks. I have a longtime correspondent, a person who started writing me emails more than a decade ago, and he's a banjo player and he's deaf and he teaches banjo and he does these Creative Commons licensed banjo seminars. And then people come to him and he teaches them, and his hearing has been getting worse and worse. And he's had cochlear implants, and the cochlear implants died. This software crashed, and he spent months and then years trying to get the company to update the software, and they just wouldn't do it. They wouldn't acknowledge that there was a problem. He couldn't take it to anyone else. And he sent me an email. It's got a happy ending because they finally came around, but he sent me an email at the start of the pandemic saying, I'm just hanging up my banjo. I'm going to be deaf for the rest of my life.
Oh my
God. I'm removing the external portion of my cochlear implants. I've given up on hearing. I just can't do this anymore. Finally, they fix it, right? But, you know, the idea that you can't get something fixed, especially medical devices, is really important. And, you know, one of the things that the other side always says when it comes to medical devices or medical equipment, like ventilators, is if you let third parties fix your stuff, they might do something wrong that could hurt you. Fair enough, right? But you know what? It turns out that if you let the manufacturer fix it,
they can also
screw it up and hurt you.
Absolutely.
Medtronic, which is the largest medical implant vendor in the world, that did a reverse merger so that it basically bought an Irish company that became its parent company so that it could be in a tax-free environment. The largest one of these tax inversions of the history of the world. They have unbelievably bad cybersecurity track records. Like, their pacemakers could be reprogrammed at 10 feet wirelessly to kill you. And the idea that Medtronic is out there saying, well, if you let third parties make pacemaker software or repair pacemakers or, you know, do any kind of work on them, you could get really badly hurt, would be a lot more credible if letting them do it didn't put you at mortal peril. And, you know, ultimately, if we want companies to do good service, we should just have consumer protection laws that punish companies that do bad service, whether it's the manufacturer or a third party.
Right. You know, we have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Elizabeth Warren was a big part of that, but it's been toothless since it's formed. Obama didn't put her on there, and all kinds of politics got in the way. And then, of course, Trump came in and wanted to just, you know, defang it anyway. Well,
and in between there, their handpicked guy who was guaranteed a 10-year seat decided he was going to go do a failed bid for governor.
Richard Cordray, right?
And I think, wasn't it Steve Mnuchin who became the director for a while?
Probably.
CFPB? Like, talk about foxes in the hen house, right?
No kidding.
So, yeah, it's I mean, CFPB, so they're it looks like Chopra is going to run CFPB.
And which again, will be great.
Yeah, he got stuff done. He got stuff done at the FTC. You know, when I was not even contemplating the possibility that Lena Khan could run the FTC, I was very excited about Chopra running the FTC. I don't know who they're going to get to fill a seat. That seat will require Senate confirmation at the FTC. But, you know, while they have a quorum at the FTC before he leaves, they're getting a lot of stuff done.
Good. Well, and another one of the provisions from the 72 that Joe Biden has in this executive order, what makes it easier for people to get refunds from airlines, not only for flight issues, but the in-flight Wi-Fi when it screws up. And I mean, you know, for once, it seems like finally, at least somebody's paying lip service to giving the consumer a fair shake. Whether it happens or not is another thing. But the other part of it, he created a council to oversee these things to make sure, like that it's not just an executive order going out into the ether. People are now responsible to ride herd over these things to make sure they get done.
It's pretty amazing, and you know, like if this were Trump administration, where you either had agency people who Trump hadn't appointed, who ran counter to his agenda, or people who were just kind of self-interested grifters who were clearly like, you know, just wanted to like rake up money and stick it in their pocket and split, I would be a little skeptical of what an EO could do. But, you know, when you have the actual agency heads saying this is the marching orders I always wanted. That feels like, you know, that the EO, it's not just symbolic, like it could get stuff done. I'm sure a lot of people watching, listening to this are like, I've run out of hope.
Yeah.
You know,
but this was the most hopeful thing we've seen in a long time.
It's amazing.
Right.
It really is. Like, I feel like I'm jinxing it. Like I'm cursing it by saying that, but you know, I like a lot of people, I read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, that book about media criticism. And a lot of it is about the Lincoln-Douglas debates and just how sober the Lincoln-Douglas debates were and how long they were and how Americans had these incredible attention spans. And I didn't know much about them. I was a Canadian. We didn't get American history. But then the BBC put out a 16-hour recording of the Lincoln-Douglas debate. So I listened to it. Lincoln was kind of a dick.
Was he?
He didn't like Black people.
Oh.
Lincoln thought Black people couldn't self-govern. Wow. He was not an abolitionist.
No, that he was.
Lincoln became an abolitionist because the electorate pushed him into it, right? Not because of his conviction. He had some convictions for sure, But Lincoln was not a fire-breathing racial equality advocate. He was a middling, middle-of-the-road, compromise-oriented, not establishment, but like not a radical change candidate. That's not what he ran on.
Right.
But it's what he became. And, you know, I've always been skeptical of the great man theory of history. I don't like cults of personality. Mm-hmm. But if it's not the great man, then what is it? What are the forces that bear down on the moment? I think it's us, right? Like, I think it's people claiming the moment. And, you know, hearing Jim Jordan stand up and say dumb things about tech, it makes my eyes bleed. Sure. Right. But the fact that Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and Pramila Jayapal are all there diagnosing in some way or another a serious rot in this industry that I've been campaigning on for 20 years. And that, like, none of them are, I mean, I disagree with all of them, Jayapal the least, obviously, but I think that all of them are right about at least some of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that this has become central enough that they're willing to stand up and make a big deal out of it is not because they themselves are fed up. I think it's because we, the electorate, have made this political moment happen, and we have the chance to carry it forward, to give it real momentum, to make new stuff happen.
To make new stuff happen. There's the rub. All right, we'll take one more quick time out, come back on the other side and wrap up this fascinating conversation with author and antitrust expert activist Cory Doctorow. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the Bradcast. It's Nicole Sandler filling in today for Brad and Desi on the Bradcast. We're in the middle of a conversation I had last week with author, journalist, and copyright and antitrust activist Cory Doctorow. If you're not familiar with him, you should be. He's one of those fascinating people whose work spans a lot of different areas. He's published a slew of books across different categories, science fiction and young adult novels to nonfiction books, some dealing with today's topic as well. You can get info on his background, his bio, the books at craphound.com. He blogs daily at pluralistic.net. You can also subscribe to that content in his daily Substack newsletter and follow Cory Doctorow on Twitter at Doctorow. We were talking about President Biden issuing this executive order, which is huge. It's a big deal. But I was kind of surprised that they did it on a Friday afternoon. That's the time usually reserved for the news dump, for stories that they really don't want the press to dwell on. This news broke on a Friday afternoon. Why, you know, that's where they, with the graveyard of news announcements, the Friday afternoon news dump, why he chose to do this on a Friday afternoon, I don't know. But I'm watching the Sunday shows yesterday thinking that they're going to talk about this is going to be a big story. And I'm like, where is everyone? Where's the euphoria that I'm feeling? Why isn't the news media talking about what a big deal this is? I don't
well,
get it.
You're doing your bit here.
I am. Yes. Well, here we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I also think that, like, so I've been in media a long time too. And sometimes when it's a story that you just don't understand, right? Like, so yes. Antitrust. Like,
it's complicated. We won't talk about
it. Reagan era antitrust, Robert Bork Sr., like, his big innovation was to say that you could only measure monopolies using these very complicated mathematical models that the Chicago School, you know, the people who like helped Pinochet murder 40,000 people, the Chicago School economists knew how to construct, and no one else knew how to construct or interpret. And they explicitly wanted to take antitrust and anti-monopoly enforcement away from something that dealt with your day-to-day life, right? Like what working conditions you lived under, whether your water or air were poisoned, you know, what not just the prices you paid, but whether you trusted your politicians or you thought they were in the pocket of a concentrated industry, right? All of that stuff was ripped out of it. And instead, the only way you could talk about whether monopoly was good or bad was to use this complicated math that nobody understood, that referred to concepts that nobody understood, that was just steeped in jargon. And so if you're a lay reporter or general reporter or even a politics reporter, and someone comes along and they say, like, look, there's this controversy and it's about, like, I don't know, like the Fermi paradox or the Higgs boson or something. Right. And, you know, it's like, it's a big deal. The president just put out an EO about the Higgs boson. And like, it's going to be really important. Like, I could see how you might go, like, yeah, you know, this sounds like a thing that a bunch of eggheads might care about. But like, no one who watches will cares. And I don't understand it well enough to make them care. Maybe they'll catch up with us, right? Maybe the subject that has been at the periphery deliberately out of our reach, where we've been told that we're just not smart enough to talk about it. Stay in your lane. This is not something for you, the average person, to concern yourself with. Maybe as we move it into this, and one of the things that's in Biden's EO is a repudiation of Borkism. It just says, like, actually, the reason we care about monopolies is we care about harmful dominance, not just consumer welfare, not just where the prices go up, but whether our political landscape is dominated by a handful of industrial billionaires, whether our job market is being crushed by monopolistic firms, whether suppliers are being destroyed by dominant sellers, what's called monopsony, like Walmart, where if you sell into Walmart, they ruin your business with these onerous conditions because they've got the only access to in-person retail for wide swaths of the country. Amazon does the same thing for e-commerce.
Sure.
You know, and Biden said, we are explicitly no longer a nation that only cares about antitrust when it comes to consumer welfare. We care about the whole package. And this is wild. And it's going to be wild around the world because, you know, that's the black letter law in the European Union. The European Union law says we care about monopolies for all of the reasons encompassed by harmful dominance and not because of consumer welfare. And yet every time there's antitrust enforcement or anti-monopoly enforcement in Europe, they talk about their antitrust laws as though they were consumer welfare laws. Hmm. Like, they've been so steeped in the orthodoxy that they can't escape it. And if they can just get out of this, like, mind palace that they've been imprisoned in, their actual laws already give them the power to enforce on the basis of harmful dominance and not consumer welfare. So, you know, we poison their minds, right? European antitrust is, it was created in them with a Marshall Plan, right? It was Reconstruction stuff. We originally built it on Rooseveltian lines around harmful dominance. Then we poisoned it as we poisoned our own. Now, as we free ourselves from this ideological virus that Robert Bork infected us with, maybe they'll be able to break free too, maybe without us kind of continuing to push them into ignoring what their laws say and acting as though our laws were their laws. Maybe they'll finally be able to actually cope with this.
Yeah, it may be. And you hit on something else. I mean, I listened to Joe Biden's speech on Friday when he announced this executive order, and I read the highlights and that stuff. But what he said was, this was a 40-year failure. It failed horribly. And the people that lost were you. I mean, he didn't say those exact words, but that's what he was saying. This is that. I mean, I got goosebumps because you don't hear. And I certainly didn't expect it from Joe Biden, of all people. You know, I'm pleasantly surprised. You know, as much as I want to criticize some other aspects, I'm wanting to cut him some slack now and say, we need to all get on this and make and elevate it so everyone knows what we're talking about. And I get it, you know, the lowest common denominator for cable news. They just go for what the masses can understand. We can understand the right to repair. We can understand the right to get a refund from the airlines when they screw us over. We can understand the right to take your phone to another carrier or to not have a no-compete clause. I mean, all this stuff. And
non-compete clauses, the leading users of non-compete clauses are fast food restaurants.
That's insane.
So that one McDonald's franchisee won't poach the other one's manager and give her a dollar extra an hour.
Ugh, that's sickening.
Right? Can you imagine being locked out of working in restaurants for 3 years because you are a management trainee at a McDonald's?
No.
I mean, it's brutal. Yeah, this. I know we're not, the public has not yet figured this out. And like I said at the start, I think the reason the public hasn't figured this out yet is they haven't made these connections. Mm-hmm. They haven't connected big tech with antitrust. They haven't connected big finance with antitrust. They haven't connected Postmates with antitrust, you know, and the destruction of their local restaurants. You know, all this predatory conduct is the result of monopolism. You know, the private equity mergers are mergers that are only permitted because we're not enforcing antitrust law. We're not enforcing the prohibition on predatory mergers, on anti-competitive mergers. So, you know, people are angry about private equity. It's not like there's no one out there in America in the heartland going like, when I grow up, I hope I get to work in private equity. Because as far as I can tell, it's an honest and upright profession that's just building this country up. You know, people hate those people. They just know that those people are terrible, right? But what they don't know is that the thing that makes them terrible, the thing that lets them be terrible, is forbearance on anti-monopoly law. And that's what makes this stuff really powerful. It's a big, deep structural shift in the way that industry, government, and the public will relate to one another. And it puts the government and the public in this on the same side, mm-hmm. in guarding against industrial overreach. And it's been the government and industry on the same side, guarding against public benefit.
Right.
And it's hugely transformative. Whether or not he'll make it happen, I think, depends on what we do. But if there was ever a moment for it, this is it.
This is it. And there's already been, look, it's only been, today's the first business day since the announcement. Sure. And already big industry is pushing back. Big push back from the big corporations, the monopolies, who like things just the way they are. Thank you very much.
Totally. Well, and you know, the Sunday shows might not have covered it, but the financial press had the stock charts of the hearing aid monopolist, which looked like, you know, an avalanche in the Alps, you know.
Wow.
It was, investors know why they're invested in monopolies, mm-hmm. right? They're not invested in them because they make the best products or because people love what they sell. They're invested in them because they have no competition.
Right.
And as soon as you say, hey, you know what? Like, you're going to have to let other people fix your stuff or sell your stuff or whatever. You know, investors get out.
Right. Now, still with all this stuff, and this is a sea change, and there's a ton of stuff here. I think there's still no motion when it comes to the Telecommunications Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, digital rights management, things like that. This is still an area that needs to be fixed, yes?
100%. There's a net neutrality order in Biden's order, which is good.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that coming back. But yeah, there's the copyright reform isn't in there, anti-circumvention reform. And these are powerful anti-competitive weapons. You know, so you mentioned the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Clinton signed it into law in 98.
Yep.
And it's a law that has many provisions, but one says that you're not allowed to tamper with or remove a digital lock, even for a legal purpose. And that means that, like, if there's a lock that prevents you from swapping the screen on your iPhone, and you put a new screen in, you can't bypass the lock. Now, we might make a law that forces Apple to bypass the lock. That's how the right to repair bills do it, okay. right? If they just force Apple to bypass the lock for you. But, you know, it would be much better if, in addition to that, we just had the right to, like, bypass the locks on our own things, the things we own that we bought, you know, that so that we could, rather than, say, waiting for the FTC to smack NVIDIA for poisoning its little video dongles and putting ads all over our screens, we just break the bootloader and put an alternative version of Android that wasn't covered in ads on it.
Right.
Right. Not only would that be a great adjunct to FTC enforcement, it might actually stay the hand of NVIDIA, because, like, the reason NVIDIA did this is they know they can get away with it. Even if there's enforcement against them, it'll be years from now. It'll be a long process. If, like, NVIDIA doing that immediately triggered someone investing in a small business whose job it is to make alternative NVIDIA firmware, mm-hmm. and sell it to people and show them how to install it on their NVIDIA sticks so they don't have to see ads anymore. Why would NVIDIA do that? They know that they would immediately be checked by it and that it would just make them peripheral to people's use of NVIDIAs, and that now people would have another channel they got their NVIDIA software from, and so on.
His name is Cory Doctorow. You can follow him on Twitter at Doctorow. You can find his website craphound.com or his blog at pluralistic.net. And the more you read him, the more you learn. The guy's pretty fascinating. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did and are as excited about the possibilities of finally enforcing our antitrust laws. You know, putting the little guy first, what a concept. And with that, we are done. Thank you for joining me. Brad and Desi will be back for the next episode of The Bradcast. Until then, I'm Nicole Sandler of NicoleSandler.com, wishing us all good luck, world. We really need it.